Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody, and thanks again for joining us for another edition of Midrats. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And as a reminder, those that are joining us live, if you're so inclined, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. You'll find a link to our chat room there if it's not already up and running. That's a good place in the course of the show. If there's an observation or a question perhaps you would like to ask our guests, or if we're not taking the show quite in the direction you wanted and would like to give us a little course correction, that's a great place to do it. We're going to be monitoring during the course of the show. And if you got something that's better than what we have, we'll grab that and we'll pull that into the conversation as things go forward. If you got to leave halfway through the show, or if we happen to have a really good question we want to get out and the show ends right at the top of the next hour, it still records afterwards. You can go back and get the full archive over Blog Talk Radio, where if you want to catch up on some previous shows, you can grab them there as well. So let's get on with the show. Before the latest developments in the Syrian civil war seemed to suck a lot of the national security oxygen out of the air, there was a lot of conversation about the air-sea battle concept, offshore balancing, a lot of similar concepts that we've talked about on the show here a few times, that is looking at how we address the challenges of the Pacific and Indian Ocean over the course of the next century. And a lot of that conversation has taken place from the guys wearing black and blue from an air and a naval perspective. And that really isn't a balanced view of things. And we want to take that thread and pull on a bit to look at what exactly from the ground perspective there is in that concept, the challenges of the Pacific and in the Indian Ocean. And our guest today, I think, is spot on to do that. Building off his May 2013 Armed Forces Journal article titled Back to Reality, Why Land Power Trumps in the National Rebalance Towards Asia, where you can find a link to that over at the show page as well. The author for the full hour today with us will be Major Robert Chamberlain, United States Army. Major Chamberlain, he served two tours in Iraq back in 03, 04, and 07 and 08. He studied refugees at Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship and is currently finishing his dissertation in political science over at Columbia. He teaches international relations right now to the cadets over at West Point. And as a final note to keep him out of trouble, we do need to point out that Major Chamberlain's views are strictly his and do not necessarily reflect those of the United States Military Academy, the Army, or the Department of Defense. With all that done, Robert, welcome to Midrats. Robert. You see, that's my fault right there. I had your mic muted. It did it automatically. Robert, sorry about that. Welcome to Midrats.
Hey, good to be on the show.
I appreciate it. Just as kind of an opening kickoff for those that maybe read the article back in May and haven't gotten to it since, or are just being lazy and haven't clicked on the link to look at it right now, let's just kind of set the ground using that article as a touchstone. Is, as an Army officer and from the ground perspective, you know, looking at the conversation that's been going on the last few years about, for lack of a better phrase, we'll just generally call the air-sea battle concept, what do you see has been good about the discussion, and what are some of the areas you think are not being addressed that are important?
Well, I mean, what's been great about the discussion is, I think, as an operational template, air-sea battle is fantastic. You know, I actually, when I was training MIT teams as a battery commander back in 08-09, worked with a lot of Navy folks, with a lot of Air Force folks, and I think there's a real kind of spirit of jointness that's pervasive in our armed forces right now, and that's kind of fed into the joint combined entry operations stuff we've been working on, and kind of looking at a lot of these scenarios of how can we come together and make things work better. And I got the chance to talk to some of the folks who worked on Air Sea Battle at the Inception, and I think it was really designed as an operational template of how do we get these two kind of maritime components and air components talking to each other to effectively move forces into theater. So that's all been great. The thing that I think has been unfortunate is in the absence of a clearly articulated national strategic objective of what is it we want out of our engagement with China, Air Sea Battle has kind of been forced to morph itself into something it wasn't intended to be, which is a strategic template. And it's filling this vacuum because there's nothing else there, and it doesn't seem to be alternatives on the table. And if anything, that's only gotten worse, so the debate has become, oh, is the best course of action to project power directly onto mainland China, or is it better to bottle up the Straits of Malacca, neither of which strikes me as a very good idea, and it's probably not the most productive discussion we could be having.
Well, before we get into the nitty-gritty of this, one of the things that struck me about your article was the title. Did you choose the title Back to Reality, or is that, and if so, why Back to Reality? Why that as a title?
Well, because it was about a return to a defensive realism, in many ways, written it kind of more of a liberal interventionist mindset. So to say, like, hey, you know, when we think about China as a problem set and an opportunity set, there's a lot that we can take from this very modest, kind of risk-averse, defensive realist approach to policymaking, as opposed to a very super aggressive, very forward-leaning, transformative, what's in the literature called a liberal an idealist approach to policymaking. And so to me, that was really the realist element, is that when we reach back into kind of this academic tradition, we kind of have some very important lessons about how do you induce insecurity in others, right? How are the things that you're going to do to enhance your own security going to have the unfortunate effect of causing other people to react badly and in the long run reducing your security. And so that got me thinking about the conflict spiral and got me thinking about what's the natural reaction going to be when our national security discussion is all about projecting power into China. You know, when if we want a defensive outcome, I think the more modest approach will actually get us where we want to be, provided that's what we're looking for.
I think one of the when I first read your article, one of the things that kind of had me go, you know, he's kind of right, is in the air and the naval centric discussions of the concept. When you're sitting on the other side of the table and wearing your red hat, it seems very, very offensive minded, and that conflict spiral you mentioned has a pretty steep curve to it. When you start smacking things, you know, let's talk about it, China. When you start smacking things on the Chinese mainland, which while you're building and discussing and maybe shaping your forces to follow through on wanting to be able to pursue this, like you said, it's not a strategic concept. It's more of an operational way of doing things. But it can create some undesirable effects in peacetime, and the message it sends to China about what your intentions are and what you'd want to do. And in my mind, you know, you always think about if an army is on the ground, few things are more hostile and aggressive than a standing army on the ground. But you kind of turn that on its head and talk about the defensive and calming nature that ground forces have that may be a little opposite than what air or naval forces have. How do you see that playing out in peacetime effects and the messages that sends for the conversation we've been having about it so far?
Well, it's really interesting because I think it changes so much when you go from a very terrestrial theater like Europe to a really maritime theater like the Asia Pacific. So in Europe in the Cold War, if you scale up your conventional ground forces, that's enormously threatening, because that's the way you're going to get into the Soviet Union and into the Soviet bloc, right? That's really scary. And your air and naval forces have this great kind of, you can slow them in, but you can slow them back. Right? I mean, so they're a much better equalizer in some ways. And I think we've gotten used to thinking in that way. And so now it's totally reversed. Like, if you really want to threaten the Chinese industrial core, you know, I don't think the default plan to do that would involve start a peninsular campaign and hope for the best after working your way through a client state or up from the south over a mountain chain or all these other things. Whereas if you really wanted to threaten kind of the Chinese heartland, you could do it from the sea, right? So when you think about the types of forces that can engage in deterrence by denial, so, you know, we'll kind of build a missile shield. Well, those can be purely defensive if they're ground-based forces. You know, some guys with some rockets on a concrete pad and a barracks, and you're done. Whereas when you talk about the naval forces that you need to do that, they're sort of indistinguishable from the naval forces that you would want to put in place if the plan was to strike directly at the Chinese heartland. I'm not an expert on that side of the house. But I think that's the real issue, is that if all we want to do is keep disputes from taking a military direction, keep them on the diplomatic and economic tracks, which I think is great. Like, you know, we're going to have disagreements with the Chinese and they're going to want to do things in their region, and I think that's entirely reasonable. Let's keep those disputes diplomatic. Let's take military options off the table, and I think we can do that by just bolstering the defense of allied states in the region with essentially anti-missile technologies and some anti-aircraft technologies. And I think when you put our naval and air forces in the region, you actually increase the militarization of the conflict, because those are the only things that can really, really hurt Chinese core national interests and turn a peripheral dispute into something much more serious.
Well, let's talk about that defensive nature of the systems you would see going into place. How exactly would that work? You're talking about anti-missile defenses, anti-aircraft defenses, things that are obviously defensive in nature, but how would we get them into the theater, and where would we have these things to provide coverage for our allies and not necessarily threaten the Chinese or any other factor out there?
Well, I mean, we know... Yeah, I just want to make sure that I'm staying on the right side of classifications. We know that there's a regional demand and a global demand, for example, for the PAC-3 anti-missile systems. And that's a growth branch. We know, for example, the CENTCOM AOR that we're looking for in the long run, kind of moving to a bolstering our partners, and one of the real value adds is our air defense and missile defense capabilities. So I think, you know, those are high technology and kind of intricate systems that are the sort of things that we're really, really good at, that you can just stick on the ground and put near the high value assets that in a dispute between China and a small regional state, there might be a temptation on the Chinese side to threaten with military force. And you just take that off the table, right, by rendering the threat moot.
One of the things, I'll use an army man against an army man quote, so to speak, but one of my favorite Patton quotes was, you know, fixed fortifications are monuments to the stupidity of man. And one of the things that the air power and the naval assets will talk about, I was like, hey, the great things about air and sea power is we can move around, you don't know where we're coming from, we can go, we can come back. And while you brought up Patriot, as most people see it deployed, especially in theater, like in Korea and Japan, where it's, you know, postured pretty much in a dug-in. It's relatively heavy and immobile to move around. And I don't know how much, since the end of the Cold War, air defense forces have really practiced whether, you know, inter-island or intra-island mobility to kind of move away from that, you know, man on a concrete pad, so to speak. Is that a problem in the Pacific? And is the Army looking at its air defense posture, vice how it's dug in Korea and Japan, and being able to be a little more movable and, lack of a better phrase, a little tougher target?
I mean, I know that mobility is a huge consideration in the Army, and certainly, I mean, Patriot systems can emplace themselves relatively quickly and are air transportable in a lot of ways. But, I mean, I think fundamentally you're not worried about a ballistic missile attack on some random rock somewhere. You're worried about population centers, industrial centers, ports, major transportation facilities. Like, if that's your concern, then that's the place where the missiles are. I mean, you know, you can kind of, I think, make pretty reasonable guesses about what is going to strike your adversary as a high-value target, and that's the thing you're defending. I think that it's reasonable to say that at this stage in the game, based on where we are, this is something we can do. It's low cost, it's unthreatening, kind of fits the bill for what we want in terms of pushing China away from the militarization of maritime disputes and towards diplomatic and economic mechanisms. And if in the long run we need more flexible, agile, mobile firepower that can legitimately threaten the Chinese heartland, well then, yeah, the air sea battle, that's the way to do it. I think that's a really bad outcome for us. I don't think we want to end up there. I don't think that's a good world to be in. But I don't think we should jump the gun on that either.
Well, how do you, I mean, you start off your article talking about how the Army's in search of a strategic purpose, let me see if I can... let me ask you, what the strategic purpose that you see is, exactly what?
It's funny because, I mean, the organization is deeply in search of a strategic purpose. I had a colleague blindside me with this yesterday and say, the mission of the Army is to bless. And my, you know, gut reaction was to say, to fight and win the nation's wars, which is great, but that's also, of course, the mission of the Air Force and the Navy, so it's not that helpful. And I realized that what we do is fight and win the nation's wars by achieving effects in the terrestrial domain, right? The thing that the Army can do that's unique and uniquely helpful is if it involves putting people on the ground and sustaining them there, right? So we have a campaigning capability, and an ability to put forces in the field for years if need be, and wage series of operations one after another. You know, I think that's important and that's useful, and that there's a lot you can do from the terrestrial domain because, you know, even though, 70% of the world's population lives within 50 miles of the shore, 100% of the world population lives on land. So everything that's worth having in terms of a population center has some terrestrial component to it. And if you want to destroy it, I think you can do that from the sea, but it's also very easy to defend from the land. And I think that component, in addition to kind of decisive action and contingency capabilities, is something we've not thought through.
Now, obviously, when we're talking about the, you know, Pacific Indian Ocean area, and you're talking about the U.S. population, you know, 330 million, depending on who you talk to, you know, big countries. But I think, you know, sometimes you can scale up ideas and how people are structured and how they're looking at things. And I was thinking about, you know, with a lot of the issues you brought up in your article, you know, are there places, smaller countries in this world, that are doing kind of on a smaller scale what you're looking at would it be helpful to look at, you know, how does Great Britain structure the defense to the Falklands? Or, you know, how does India, or let's say Pakistan, look and try to deter the other one with ground? Are there other nations who have concerns that might be interesting to look at along the lines that you raised?
I mean, I think it's tough because a lot of those nations have kind of dual purpose forces that have both a kind of deter the neighbors approach and a police the homeland approach. So I think it gets a little dicey. I mean, it's interesting, most of the militaries in the Asia-Pacific region, which we think of as incredibly maritime, are dominated by their armies. And I don't think that that's because, from a global perspective, that's the greatest strategic relevance they have. I think it's because, from kind of a regime perspective, it's the most important. So I don't know if there's a template. Like, I think we're kind of in uncharted waters, so to speak, of how does a great power in this unipolar moment avoid overreaching itself? How can we not antagonize other regional powers on the way up? And I don't think there's a good template. I mean, I think we're figuring this out as we go, which is partly why it's been so difficult.
You know, as I was reading your article, I had the thought about the famous island change, the String of Pearls, and I was looking at the map and looking at our own island chain, which run from the Aleutians to the Marianas to you know, any number of other stuff, and our allies in Australia, and I was thinking about how your article really fits in nicely to us defending our own island chain. Is that something you had in mind when you were writing it?
Not when I was writing it, although it's funny, my dissertation work, I've ended up looking a lot at the Middle East in the 50s, which we thought of as very terrestrial theater, and the nuclear forces. There was a little bit in the Sixth Fleet, but it was a lot of intermediate range missiles and aircraft before Polaris submarines could get kind of parked under the Sixth Fleet in the early 60s. But the Soviets, of course, saw it differently because they didn't have to mount a defensive concept from outside their own borders. They could just march southward. And so their big challenge was, how do you get at the Sixth Fleet and these Polaris submarines? And kind of looking at their naval doctrine. And I think what we've got, right, is not, we don't yet have to think about how do we defend these island chains, because of the total and really unprecedented blue water global dominance that we've established and that we're facing, I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, from a naval perspective, a challenge in China is it looks a lot like the Soviet Navy at the very beginning of the 1960s, right? It had been kind of a brown water army-dominated force that needed land-based air cover that couldn't really venture that far away from its own shores, and only now is kind of taking these first tentative steps towards how do we operate in a maritime environment that's absolutely dominated by a potential strategic adversary. And I think there are probably some important parallels to be drawn there.
One thing, and this might, Robert, this might be a little bit of a sensitive area here for you, but I'll try to word my question in a way I don't paint you to a corner. But at least on the naval side of the house, and this really is kind of criminology and court politics to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had a maritime side of the house for what I call the butt important Those things that have much institutional support, meaning four stars who have a background in things as the carrier airborne delivery, the CODs. I know the Air Force has had a problem. I think it's gotten a little bit better about the cargo air logistics side of the house, our amphibious community, some of our support ships, command ships. Just they don't get attention simply because a lot of the leadership there doesn't fully appreciate or value them simply because they don't have a seat at the table. And when you look at actually, you know, air defense, how does the institutional Army support air defense? And we saw before 9/11, the old Cold Warrior branches of the Army supported. And after 9/11, there was a little bit of an insurgency by the Special Operations Coin Center. There's even a little bit of a direct intervention to get more of those players promoted. And I know in the last few years, there's been a big push against it. So I know there's a big wrestling match going on in the Army. But for those parts of the community and for that philosophy, defensive like that, institutional support is there in the Army? And are there a couple of senior 3-4 stars that are kind of writing and thinking that perhaps our listeners would want to, you know, keep an ear for, who may be bringing this conversation to the big tables?
Well, I think as I look, you know, specifically the air defense community writ large, we recently actually merged the field artillery and air defense schools into the Fire's Center of Excellence, because that's what we've decided to call our schools now. So I think there's a big merger there, and certainly after getting rockets shot at us for the last 12 years or whatever it's been, I think there's a real appreciation of how unpleasant that is and how nice it is to have a branch of the service that helps you take care of those sorts of things. And I think air defenders have certainly worked a lot, and it's interesting, as I talk to cadets, because we actually, this last week, they chose their branches or put in their bids. I think there's a real attraction to air defense because their pitch is, no matter what happens in the next 10 years, we have a real-world mission and you're going to go on deployments. I think there certainly is an across-the-board belief in this is an important tool, and they've been doing the real-world mission. And I know, again, making sure I stay on the right side of the class line, that we intend to maintain air defense in various theaters, kind of regardless of how we draw down our posture in other ways, that's a major value add, a major contribution. Relatedly, I know there's huge growth in kind of some of the other aspects that I talked about in our space operations branch. It's another set of terrestrial-based systems that you can use for signaling, you can use for defense, and a bit of offense. And I know there's a lot of growth in our cyber systems. And I think all of those sort of, like, not big war sort of systems and communities really are getting a seat at the table. Like, there's a lot of interest, and there's a lot of funding coming down from General Odierno, so from the chief's level, that recently set up like the Army Cyber Center at West Point, specifically to look at both technical tools and also kind of doctrinal innovations. So yeah, I think there's a lot of things going on. I think it really comes from the top. There's an across the board proponency for what these systems bring to the table.
Well, a lot of the Missile Defense Agency stuff is, in fact, Army-driven, I think. So, and I'm curious as about whether, you know, we have this X-band radar that's on a floating platform. Is it possible? Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just agreeing. Yeah, the X-Band radar on the floating platform.
Yeah. Is there a possibility that some of the ways we could do what you're talking about is to have systems that are not only deployable on land, but to have them a little more mobile on platforms like the one the X-Band radar is on?
If you can deploy it by itself, I think the answer is yes. My concern is, and I think this is the advantage of using a terrestrial system, is that you can't deploy the platform without escort. And then you don't want just the platform, you know, the sensor and the shooter. So then you need an escort, and then you don't just want two surface vessels, so you kind of need air cover, you need all these other things, and pretty quickly you've kind of scaled yourself back into an air-sea battle. Like, you need some ability to defend these sailors that you're putting out there, initially for purely defensive purposes, but the logic of how do we defend this defensive asset demands that you end up with some sort of offensive capability. And the difference being, if you got folks parked on the tarmac, the defensive capability is sort of a barbed wire fence and then a garrison element, which can be a host nation garrison element, doesn't have to be U.S., that just sits there and doesn't have the capacity to project power beyond its borders. So I think, for me, that's where the preference for a terrestrial system comes from. But that said, you do lose the flexibility. So if you are kind of doing crisis diplomacy and you need systems that give you the ability to quickly move it in place, I think that maritime makes a lot of sense. That's probably the way to go.
Another thing that got my attention is, at least from the naval point of view, when we talk about anti-access and area denial, or everybody's favorite acronym, A2AD. You know, from our perspective, that's a very offensive thing, which is kind of funny because it only takes place when we decide to put our carriers off somebody else's beach, which is a little bit of an offensive action on our part. But you mentioned the fact that, A2AD, it's actually a defensive concept. And there are ways that we can do it as well. We just don't have to be on the receiving end. We could be on the delivering end of it. What are those things in our toolbox we can use to do our own A2AD? And, you know, where are those places in the Pacific are the natural terrestrial places that we could set up and be able to do that?
Well, I think the issue is that we've, because we have such a dominant Blue Water Navy and a dominant air component, we really haven't thought a lot about terrestrial A2AD. You know, I mean, if I had to place bets on what's the country who could come up with, you know, a smart ship-seeking ballistic missile, I'd say that we could do it faster than anybody else if we wanted to. And that might be a good place to put defense dollars. And it's funny, I mean, if you find yourself out in San Francisco, you can go out on the bluff and look. There are the shore batteries, and then later the missile batteries, and later the atomic missile batteries, used to be to protect San Francisco Bay. We used to do it all the time. Like, A2AD is not an innovative new concept in the history of human warfare. It's just the ranges have gotten a lot longer. And I think if we choose to do that, if we say, hey, we think that there's a real threat coming at allies of ours, we have the opportunity to develop systems either on our own or do co-development, co-production, the Eurofighter kind of being a sterling example of countries coming together to decide they want to build something. I think we have technologically advanced allies in the region that might be interested in working on something like that. And we can build our own A2AD and not have to worry about it. And then, of course, like part of, you know, we talked about area denials, the movement within theater stuff. Like, I mean, our air defenders already have those capabilities. They don't get to exercise them as often because usually the enemy aircraft can't get within range. They don't live that long.
Yeah, I like your comment on the A2A, whatever it is, A squared, D squared, because almost every port I've been in around the world has some old fort at its entrance where the guns used to stop people from entering the port. As you say, it's been around a long time. It just all that's changed is the weaponry. So as I understand it, what we're talking about is getting a system in the field, getting a defense of that system in the field. So you can put an anti-ballistic missile system out there with an anti-air system to defend it, and then have the personnel and the get that delivered someplace and then be able to sustain it in the field. Is that what you would foresee happening?
Yeah, I think that is that's an ideal outcome, and that puts us on the right side of the cost curve. I mean, both it prevents us from projecting an offensive threat, and if, you know, because, I mean, really, I feel like what we're talking about is China. I presume, maybe it's my kind of naive army faith in the Navy and Air Force, but I presume that we already have the ability to overcome the challenges of regional adversaries and put anything ashore we need to and provide air dominance. So really what we're talking about is China and their blue water Navy. We can stay off the offense, and if we can make it cheaper for us to sink ships than it is for them to build them and keep our Navy pulled back, I think you can kind of shape that buildup and shape the emergent naval doctrine, right? You know, so it's not going to be a helpful tool to throw your weight around in the region if there are very effective surface-to-surface missile capabilities that create defensive bubbles around American allied states. Yeah. You can't shoot rockets at them, you can't launch planes at them, you can't sail boats near them. So really, why bother spending all the money on a huge blue water Navy? It's not worth it.
Yeah, I don't think there's anybody in North America or Asia, for that matter, that really wants to engage in to quote the Princess Bride, to engage in a land war in Asia. But there are a lot of any excuse to quote the Princess Bride.
I wondered when that was coming.
It has to. It's a requirement. But there are a lot of nations nearby, some of which are very interesting, you know, Vietnam, Philippines, etc., that are very interested in deterring any potential Chinese expansion. And one thing that we've been looking at on the naval side of the house, as we look at, you know, things that we need to do after, you know, the conversation really, really ramped up when we were withdrawing from Iraq, is partnering with other nations and building those relationships with nations which, you know, may not be friends or allies, but may be partners at one point or another. Do you see the ability to flesh out and to better establish utilizing the Army in a more defensive posture may open up some partnering opportunities from the ground that may not have been there otherwise, because they would have been seen as perhaps a little bit too offensive to the people on the other side of the border?
Well, I think so. And I think, you know, I mean, it's funny, like I was saying earlier, these are countries whose militaries are dominated by their land forces, you know, so there's already kind of speaking the same language. And what's nice kind of about where, you know, Vietnam and Thailand are at in terms of capabilities is they really don't need, nor would I imagine they would particularly want, like a huge brigade-sized, you know, infantry armor-heavy element, because they have that stuff. You know, they know what they want. What we can give that I think becomes helpful is the sort of like high-tech, high-cost systems that are your kind of air defense, anti-missile, ballistic missile defense, et cetera, that also have a small footprint. Also, you can kind of concentrate, so you don't have, you know, 20,000 soldiers who, God bless them, are not necessarily always the best ambassadors at every given moment for the American cause, spread all over the countryside. Like, you can really get a lot of leverage out of a small group of people using land forces, and I think it becomes tougher when instead of being able to say, hey, we're going to help you defend yourselves by kind of deterring by denial. It's like, oh, well, we'll help deter the Chinese by involving you in the system of deterrence by punishment, so we'll be able to go ashore and bomb them. And I think, you know, if you're kind of a regional ally, you're like, well, look, I'm not looking for trouble here. I don't want you to pull me into something. You guys have, you know, you, America, and you, China, have a lot of your own stuff going on. So let's talk about where my interests are. And so, yeah, I really think the ground component has a huge part to play in this. And I think the chief put that out there in the prevent, shape, win template, that these shaping operations, these relationships we build, are one of the major value adds of the Army, in addition to our ability to fight and win big terrestrial wars.
Yeah, I must admit, when I first started reading your article, I thought, here's an Army guy trying to justify the Army's existence. But as I went through it and as we've talked, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for the concept you're presenting here. What kind of feedback have you received from folks in your business from your article?
A lot, overwhelmingly positive. Mostly, I think. I mean, it's been great because all the Navy people I know saw it on your blog and immediately pinged me and let me know that I was internet famous. And then, you know, I think within the department, there's certainly, you know, I got lots of good comments. And, you know, I think the extent that there's been some criticism, and I think it is perhaps warranted, is to say, you know, this really treats the U.S. and China as kind of black boxes that don't have histories or identities. And then, in fact, when you impose a set of, like, Chinese strategic thought and Chinese history on this calculation that you have been making, the case is actually much starker. You know, so China is more than just a country with a set of capabilities. It's a group of people that have their leaders have lived experiences that needs to be taken into account. So I've been reading and thinking about that.
I'd like to keep hitting on that subject you just mentioned, because one thing back in 2007, the Navy came out with an updated, they called it a strategy, I called it a variety of other adjectives, I think called it cooperative strategy for the 21st century. And one of the criticisms of it is it really talked around the C word, China. And there is a lot of hesitancy when you're discussing about what type of capabilities that we may need or our potential opponents may be, about the China growth, whether it's economic, their military growth, kind of their, you know, they're stretching, feeling themselves out. And there are a lot of, I call them the China historical compassion trolls, who will do exactly what you say. But, you know, I'm a big fan of history, and I'm a big fan of making sure that you can see context to action. But it is healthy to look at just capabilities and perhaps get a little bit of intent, and then season it a bit with understanding their history and perhaps some of their motivations. But what, besides people just wanting to do that academic discussion about China's history, where do you see this hesitancy coming from about being rather stark in the discussions about, hey, this is a potential rival that could, you know, countries do stupid stuff all the time that other countries have to react to. Where do you see on the academic side of the house a lot of this pushback from really just being able to say China as opposed to this amorphous potential thing that's somewhere west of San Francisco?
I mean, I would say on the academic side of the house, it is that sort of concern. I mean, it's, you know, from the policy side, I think it makes a lot of sense of you don't want to start using language that then determines the outcome. So that if you start describing someone as threat and adversary, they're going to start acting that way because that's how they think that you think and they're listening. On the academic side, I mean, I think that there is sort of an open discussion. In fact, Andrew Nathan is a great China specialist from Columbia, and I don't think has stars in his eyes since he's banned from the country, wrote an article about how China views the West based on their strategic publications and said, you know, they're really attracted to the doctrine of offensive realism. They think that great powers are driven to kind of preemptively expand, and that they view the U.S. as doing that. They view us as like expansionist, aggressive, and all these things. You know, I think there's a lot of questions about, is China rising? Is China going to overtake the United States? Like, what is the rate of growth of the two? Especially on the academic side, it's actually the conversation is much starker. I mean, there's something with it.
Yeah, to follow up kind of on what Sal's saying, though, I think you hit a lot of good points when you note that a ship that is a ballistic missile defense ship also is capable of offensive operations. And one of the hesitancies I think that we have is that we keep all we have. We don't have defensive ships. We have ships that can be defensive and offensive, but they're both simultaneously. I think one of the points of your article is well taken is shouldn't be any hesitancy on our part to go defensive the way you've described it by putting a defensive installation in and defending it. Have you gotten feedback on that?
Well, I think what's interesting about it is, you know, in talking to people in the Army about what we do, because I think like all the services, we tend to maybe watch our own recruiting videos more than we should. You know, it's not like the human domain, and it's not leadership and trust, because, I mean, all the services do these things. You know, there's the thing that we have, I think, that the terrestrial element gives us that you can't do on water and you can't do in the air because humans weren't designed to live there, is the ability to kind of disaggregate and disperse. Right? So if you're going to build a ship, you're going to have to put a bunch of people in it. And if you're going to go to the expense of the ship with a bunch of people in it, you're going to want it to do more than one thing, usually, or be part of a force package that does lots of different things. You need to build the flexibility in if you're going to have something float out there, because it's rather foolish to have limited capability. And you can't deploy 20 people or 120 people and a missile battery, and that's it. And I think what the Army, with the terrestrial element, gives us is you can disaggregate these systems and pluck them out, say, oh, well, actually, all we want is the sensor. You know, all we want is a sensor and one kind of shooter, and that's it. Or a sensor shooter and a small garrison element, and they're dispersed. They're hard to kill all at once. You know, I mean, you can't sink the entire battery. Like, it's going to take you a lot of rounds to get a kind of 100% probability of kill over this highly dispersed element connected by fiber optic cables. You know, and we can take that risk. I think coming around to that idea, which is a different role for us, is it's going to take some time. I mean, there's the Army kind of our identity crisis continues, you know, because there is the commitment to, yes, we can disperse, yes, we can go defensive. We also have to be able to aggregate, concentrate, and win the major decisive engagement. And so we're still having all the big units go through a decisive action training event where you practice a big fight because we have to win that. That's what we do. But then that creates a shift of like, okay, but if what we really do is operate in these small broken down components, is the decisive action less important? You know, is it more important to have commanders that operate autonomously or more important to have commanders that are able to, like, fit themselves in and integrate in the system? And I don't think that's getting resolved. You know, I think it's going to be a pretty gut-wrenching thing that's going to take years and not months to work out in the aftermath of the two wars, you know, one of which we're still in the process of trying to wrap up.
I'll have you put on your West Point instructor hat here for a little bit. Not like you didn't have it before, but you know, you brought up the fact, you know, a lot of the writing that the Chinese have been putting out, and a lot of it is actually surprisingly available for open source if you want to dig into it, translated or not. And we've been intrigued over the last few years. They really like to read Alfred Thayer Mahan, and anything that's being written over here. For instance, a couple of repeat guests of ours from the Naval War College, Toshi Yoshihara and James Holmes, their book, Red Star Over the Pacific, that came out just a few years ago. Toshi this summer was invited to go over to China because they were issuing the Chinese translation of it. So they are pretty good consumers of as they grow and develop their own thought about what direction they want to take their national security requirements. Kind of flipping it over, you know, here in 2013, getting one quarter closer to 2014, what do those in the American national security arena, what couple of three things do you think they should be reading to help inform their decisions and what they're looking at going forward?
One thing I think that kind of everyone in this business ought to read, a classic, would be Perception and Misperception in Internet by Robert Jervis. I assign it my courses. You know, the instructor that I co-teach with loves it, says he learned a lot from it, just thinking about, you know, when he's out working in his battalions and brigades, you know, how to apply some of these ideas, which really, I think, what it's extremely good at is calling into question how do you see yourself and how do others see you? That we tend to have self-serving biases where we know what we're doing is benign, and we make the assumption that the other people know that. So when they react badly, we assume what they're doing is aggressive because that's what we expect to see. You know, it's an older book, 76, I think, but is absolutely a classic and one that strategic thinkers ought to work their way through. One that I'm reading right now that's quite different, but it really has my wheels turning, is From the Ruins of Empire, The Revolt Against the West and the Remaking of Asia by Pankaj Mishra. It's a brand new book, you know, and it's been award nominated and other things. And it talked about a guy I knew a bit about, Al Afghani, who's kind of an early, kind of late 19th century Islamic thinker, kind of presaged of the Muslim Brotherhood and some other things. But then it's talking about kind of Chinese nationalist thought, which is not something I had ever really spent much time with. And one of the things I think that's just very striking you know, and I really learned in Iraq, you know, people tend to, like, tell the grand narrative of why two groups of people don't get along, and it goes back hundreds of years and blah, 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 and that I don't really believe. But I do believe people respond to things that happen within their lived experience, and so when you know the experiences of Iraq in the 50s and 60s, you're able to understand why the people who were children then and are in authority now make the decisions they do. I think similarly, you know, when you understand the collapse of the Qing Dynasty 100 years ago in China and the subsequent unrest and revolution, and then kind of how that manifested itself in Maoism in the 50s, you're able to understand where certain sensitivities are going to come up, and like what the relationship is with the West. And I've just been thinking a lot about it. I think it's very, very useful. Other classic texts, if I could have anyone. I have someone read about China. You know, I guess the last, it's not really about China, but it's more about what is the United States good at, why are we good at producing combat power, would be Stephen Biddle's Military Power, which I think is very helpful to study in terms of thinking through, okay, it's not just the technology, it's also the training and the employment. And so what we have, like what our value add is, of course, is we can bring a combination of technology and human expertise, and that we can send those packets, which are much more effective, for example, just selling the technology, which may be a temptation. So it helps you work through why American forces are good at what they do, and he would say it's because they're very effective at implementing the modern system of war, and talked about kind of the importance of the terrestrial environment and kind of its unique attributes. So, yeah, I guess those are my three kind of the think pieces. You know, I, obviously being more on the defensive realist end of the scale, I tend to put less emphasis on, you know, read what Chinese person X said at time Y in order to understand everything you need to understand, and say, no, it's probably more about strategic logics that apply across countries. But I think those three books give you a cross-section of both strategic logics and kind of those cultural elements. So those would be my picks off the top of my head.
Well, we're running out of time here, but let me ask you, what are we going to see some more writing from you? Have you got something coming out soon? I know you're busy with getting your degree at Columbia and teaching your classes at West Point, but what can we look forward to from you next?
I am working hard on my dissertation, which is about alliance behaviors and why great powers give away resources to small states to allies. My cases are all from the Middle East in the 1950s, because that's where you can find good archival data about why governments make decisions. My belief is that if my theory is right, where I can demonstrate in the cases, we can also apply it and maybe get some insight into Chinese strategy in Southeast Asia by looking at how they're allocating their security resources. And so I'm very interested, for example, in the Chinese relationship with Cambodia, and I'm hoping to maybe take a look at that sometime this spring.
Well, we look forward to seeing it. Wish you the best of luck in your time management exercises, and really appreciate you. Dave, yeah, I could learn probably a couple things from you. I'm not the best time manager, but really appreciate you taking time this afternoon to spend a whole hour for us. Really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, guys. Incredible experience for me, and I hope to keep learning more about naval operations and listen to the show. So thank you much.
Appreciate it. And thank you very much, everybody who joined us live. Join us again next week, where our guest will be the Chief of Naval Information, Rear Admiral Kirby. Until then, cheers.
Hello!